Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hello and welcome to AHDB's Food and Farming Podcast. I'm Emma Steele, Beef and Lamb Knowledge Exchange Manager for the Midlands, and I'd like to welcome Liz Knapp, who is currently working for the APHA, but is also a farm vet and completed an AHDB and BBSRC funded PhD last year. So today we're going to talk about foot rot and the work Liz did during her PhD looking into its control, management and use of vaccinations. And then we'll talk a little bit about lambing prep as we edge closer to that time of year for most of us if you haven't already started. So welcome to the podcast, Liz. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, Emma. You've covered the main points, really. I was in farm practice for 16 years, 15 years of that in North Devon, and in 2018 I left to do a full-time PhD, and the opportunity arose, so I grabbed it.
And were you focusing on sheep when you're in farm practice, or was it varied?
I was lucky enough to live in an area which there's a really good relationship between vets and sheep farmers, and I did spend most of my time in practice doing sheep work.
Brilliant.
All year round, all the services you could provide, I helped out with those.
Brilliant. So great to set you off on that PhD then. And when did you start that?
That was September 2018.
And then finished last year?
Yeah, so I passed my viva in November.
Brilliant. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So let's start today with lameness then. Can you talk us a bit through the different causes of lameness and how these occur on farm?
Yeah, sure. So I thought it's probably best if we focus on the infectious causes of lameness, because they tend to cause us the most headache. So foot rot and contagious ovine digital dermatitis are the main infectious causes of lameness. Foot rot is the most common. And by foot rot, I mean everything from your scald, so your sort of milder interdigital dermatitis, as we call it as well, up into severe foot rot where the horn starts to become underrun. So that's all actually caused by the same bacteria. And we would, when we talk about foot rot, certainly in terms of my PhD, that's what I'm referring to. And yet the contagious ovine digital dermatitis, we've only been really aware of it for about 25 years compared to centuries of dealing with foot rot. And we don't know nearly as much as we do about foot rot, about CODD. The research hasn't happened yet. We've been lucky enough to have a lot of funding into foot rot research over the past 20 years, so we're starting to get a picture together.
Brilliant. And what do you think the prevalence of lameness is, just general lameness in the national flock now, and where do we hope it should be?
Well, over 10 years ago, probably pushing towards 20 years ago, it was over 10%, and about 2010, the Farm Animal Welfare Committee put together a target of 2% lameness in the national flock, by which we mean basically on average, if you went to a flock over the course of the year, they would have about 2% of their sheep lame at any time. So that's been the target. The target, they gave us about 10 years for that, and we have actually gone past that. Recent estimates are probably 3-4%. So we've have done a lot of good, and we're getting there.
And just to put you on the spot with that then, what do you think the main reasons for that drop are from what you've seen in practice?
Well, I do hope that it's the fact that we understand the problem much more, and we understand the risk factors, and we're starting to get the message out that things such as routine trimming to treat actually have a adverse impact on healing from lameness and lameness prevalence in flocks. And also the fact that if you do have an animal with an active infectious disease, that it is spreading it around to all the other members of the flock, then the best thing to do with that is prompt treatment with antibiotics. So messages such as those there has been follow-up research, and those messages are filtering through, so behaviour has been changing. And I think we can attribute a lot of that drop to that.
Brilliant. So looking at your PhD more specifically then, what have you looked at as part of that research?
I've been looking at vaccination. So we've had, FootFacts has been available to us for more than a couple of decades now, I believe. And uptake of that vaccine has been quite gradual. It's probably 30 to 35% of farmers use it at the moment. And it hasn't really had the impact that we would like it to have had. So we thought it might be good to look to see if there are alternatives. And in the Southern Hemisphere, or mainly Australia, really, they've been doing a lot of work on an alternative vaccination strategy. So we thought we'd see if we could test it here and compare the results, whether it'd be a useful tool. Yeah, really, we're trying to push down towards that 2%. So we need to keep looking for solutions, really. And this was just one potential solution that had to be explored, really.
So what exactly did he do?
So the vaccine that we currently have available, the FootVax, has 10 different strains of foot rot in it. It has 9 different what we call serogroups and 2 types of a single serogroup in there. So it's a 10-strain vaccine.
So are all those 10 strains UK-specific?
Yeah, so they're all in the UK. And unfortunately for us, these strains of foot rot are completely randomly distributed across flocks. Certainly a recent survey in England where farmers were invited to send swabs, it just showed there were no patterns whatsoever. There were many, many different combinations, a number of serogroups in each flock, and it didn't really matter whether you were buying in sheep or not. And the theory is that if you put lots and lots of strains in one vaccine, then actually the sheep has a harder job to produce antibody to all 10 of those, whereas if you just pick the 2 most common strains in the flock and just put those in the vaccine to start with, that actually it raises a stronger immune response, and then hopefully the vaccine works better. So that's the theory behind testing this alternative vaccination strategy.
And what farms were you working on then? How many were involved?
Again, lucky enough to know a lot of sheep farmers in North Devon, so it was based in Devon, mid and North Devon, and I did screen a few flocks for suitability for the trial and ended up working with 3 flocks for the trial itself. So commercial flocks, mainly mule crosses,
yeah.
Terminal scar crosses. So very much everyday commercial flocks.
And what were the ewes involved getting jabbed with then?
The trial was set up so that I was completely blind to what I'd given them in terms of treatments, and it was split into 3 treatment groups within each farm. I'd gone out, it was the year before, there was a bit of a COVID sort of put a bit of a spanner in the works, but luckily it all worked out. So it was about a year before I had gone out to the flocks and looked to see which of these serogroups, these strains, were present in each flock.
Yeah.
And they all had 5 or 6, really.
And that was just swabbing cases of foot rot in the flock.
I found sheep with foot rot and I swabbed their feet.
Yeah.
And then I went back to the lab and tested them to see what was there. And then I picked the ones that were most common in those flocks. So each flock has a different combination. They actually all had serogroup H was the most common. And that's something that we see across the board in England, really, is a very common one. But the other serogroup in each of the 3 vaccines was different for each farm. So it ended up that a third of the ewes within each flock had their flock-specific vaccine, a third of them had FootVax, and then the third had a placebo, which was just sterile saline. And then I had a researcher that helped me with this, Hannah, and she covered up all the syringes for me so I couldn't see what I was injecting. And then we ran the ewes together and I had no way of telling which group they belonged to.
So the whole trial throughout then?
Yeah.
No idea what treatment?
The lab where it was also, I was blind to what I was analysing and most of the data analysis.
So what did you find then?
Well, I looked at it a couple of different ways. What we did do during this trial, that the actual data I was collecting was how many lame sheep there were every week. But I wanted to do this as part of other control measures, because we know that vaccination alone isn't going to be enough to stop some sheep getting lame, and I couldn't leave them lame. I don't want to go out and ask a farm to help me with my research and then end up with some sheep that are lamer than when they started. So
yeah.
What we did was look at every single sheep on all three farms once a week and give them a score for lameness.
And how long were you in there for, as in how many weeks was your trial?
So I started on week one with dose one. I had to give a second dose at week five because the Australian vaccine needs two doses. So they got two doses of Footvax or the Australian vaccine or saline. And then we went up to week 25, which was coinciding with the start of lambing. So it was really throughout, it was the month before the tups went in and throughout pregnancy. So no lambs were about at the time.
So you were lameness scoring them for 25 weeks then, every week?
Yeah. So if they were lame, they got caught. And then I made a note of what they had on their feet. And I also took some swabs, actually. But I also stuck to our advice and I gave them an antibiotic injection if I saw foot rot or CODD.
Yeah.
So I was trying to recreate a scenario in these flocks where there were, the farmers are trying to follow our best practice control lameness, but can't, perhaps it's not practical for them to do all the things like not catching within 3 days, not isolating them if they had infection, but doing some of the things that we're suggesting, and just to see whether you can just top up that effect by vaccinating as well. So that was really what I was measuring. When it came to analysing the results, I looked at how many cases of lameness happened over that period I was monitoring them, and then also how many ewes ever got lame.
Right.
Because one thing I was noticing being out there week on week was that you do get some sheep that are repeatedly lame.
Yeah.
And that can actually mask the effect of the vaccine, because if you don't know that it's one sheep in particular you keep treating, then it just looks like you're still getting lots and lots of cases of lameness, when actually far fewer ewes are getting lame if they've had the vaccine than if they had saline. I did it for lameness because we talk about a target lameness prevalence 2%. So I wanted to see whether putting the vaccine into the equation, much like we say in the 5-point plan, made a difference on lameness as a whole across the three flocks. I saw about a 20% reduction in the number of cases of lameness.
Right.
So any cause of lameness,
yeah,
20% reduction in both vaccines. So they were working about the same, even though I was only injecting against two of the strains.
And that was versus the placebo?
Yes,
yeah.
Versus the placebo. And say, during the trial itself, two of the three farms had 5 or 6 serogroups. The other one ended up only having 3. So that was lameness. But then when I looked at how many ewes were affected, that difference went up to around 30%. So then I decided that it is a little bit unfair asking a foot rot vaccine to protect against lameness in general, even though we know foot rot is the main cause of lameness and it's ubiquitous pretty much in flocks. And then I did see a bigger difference. So again, if I totted up all the cases and compared them, the difference was about 30%. And then if I looked at how many ewes were affected, then I got down to about a 40% reduction. But again, throughout this, both vaccines were pretty similar in their performance.
So what you were saying then about some ewes are just repeatedly lame as well, is that why it's so important to record IDs with lameness cases?
Yeah. So those are basically my conclusions, were that, I felt that this trial gave us a lot more information and about actually how our existing vaccine works, certainly within the sort of 5-point plan system. And I think the key messages were that we need to know what's going on in the flock. And to do that, we do need to keep really good records.
You just mentioned the 5-point plan then. Can you just mention what the points of that are?
Yeah, sure. So it's 5 points divided into 3 sections, really. And a little bit of the history of the 5-point plan, it was put together through the body of evidence that had been built to that point in time. It was launched not quite 10 years ago now, but we already had quite a lot of information out there. So that was put in there. But also the plan was tried out on some farms. So there's a bit of common sense stuff as well. So 3 points contribute to reducing the amount of challenge, and that's the amount of, really, we're talking about infectious disease here, so the amount of bacteria that are in the environment passing to each other. So treat, that comes from some clinical trials in the late noughties that said, if you catch and treat within 3 days and you don't trim, then you get a much faster healing time and you reduce lameness prevalence that way. And there's less than bacteria in the environment to spread around. Avoid, for me, that covers quite a few different bits and pieces. But an example of that would be maybe reduce the number of times you gather the sheep.
Right. And what so about that they where can't you spread it that them? Way? Does that need to, where you're gathering them? Does that need to be clean, or what's the best place
well,
to be doing
ideally,
that?
I yeah. mean, well, say foot rot is virtually ubiquitous, and it spreads from sheep on the ground, and there'll always be a few in there just spreading it about. So if you bring them all together, or you put them onto ground where there's been other sheep, you're always potentially spreading it that way. So quarantine is the other one about challenge. So, I mean, this actually works both ways. But if you have a flock that's in pretty good shape when it comes to lameness, maybe you don't have cod, you can easily bring in new infections. So that quarantine period is an opportunity to check them and try and avoid that happening. So that's reducing the challenge.
And just on the quarantine
as
well, if you're bringing in sheep, is it important there as well, or with foot rot and spreading foot rot and cod within your flock?
Yeah, well, you can not only introduce cod to a naive flock, but you could introduce naive strains of foot rot.
That you didn't already have.
Yes, yeah, which then they'll have to go on and develop an immunity to. Cull, for me, is one of the... Well, it's my favourite point. I think it's the one that probably has the most impact. And it's described... Well, it's in the plan under the build resilience sort of category, but it's actually more than that, because I find it in quite a lot of flocks, and I saw this when I was examining flocks, looking to recruit them. A lot of sheep that have been lame end up staying in the flock, and they're on and off lame, or they have deformed feet, which can carry the foot rot bacteria. And unless you remove those from your flock, you're never going to get on top of your lameness. You have to be really, really harsh.
And are they just hanging around because we don't know who the repeat offenders are generally? We're not writing the tags
down.
Yeah,
well, it's easy to let them slip in and get into lamb and not get rid of them when you're intending to, isn't it? So that's one side. The build resilience, the other side of that is... There is a genetic element to, well, any disease really, and resilience and resistance to disease. And if you keep sheep that don't get lame, then you keep a flock that doesn't get lame. So year on year, you are building resilience indeed by keeping sheep that don't get lame.
So on that then, you don't want to be keeping daughters off those persistently lame sheep either then?
It's not advisable.
Yeah.
So if you are breeding your own replacements... then again, it's coming back to records again, isn't it? And then, of course, the fifth point is the established immunity, which is that the use of vaccination to just top up immunity, really. So that was the 5-point plan.
So is there anything else kind of from your PhD or from what you've learned or anything like that that you think you'd like to be saying to farms to get change on farm, really?
Yeah. I think the results of the PhD itself are really reinforcing that the need to cull from... So not only in an unvaccinated flock are you probably, by culling, selecting for naturally sound sheep, but it also seems that there are sheep that are not very good at responding to the vaccine. And that's no real surprise, because any vaccine in any person or animal... the person or the animal reacts differently, again, to do with their genetics. So that does make sense, really. The other thing, actually, I looked at when I was analysing the results was the amount of antibiotic use. So I did see about a quarter of a reduction in the number of antibiotic doses within the protocol that I was using for treatment in the two vaccinated groups. So I think that's... we have to think about the big picture and responsible antimicrobial use. We can't withdraw an antibiotic treatment from a ewe that's in pain with an infectious lameness condition, but we can do everything else to try and reduce the number of ewes that we need to treat with antibiotics in the first place.
Yeah.
And it does look like that there's a role of that. Now, the only other thing that's worth mentioning is my three flocks did differ, and by far, if I analysed the flocks individually, then I yeah, by far I got most of the effect on the farm that had the most foot rot, not surprisingly. And on that farm, I was seeing proportionately, yeah, even more of a reduction in the number of antibiotic doses I was using. So I think wherever we're able to, we need to have good records and determine exactly what's going on in our flocks and causing that lameness, and making an informed decision as to whether vaccination is the way to go. Because clearly it's beneficial to some flocks.
Yeah.
Perhaps not all of them. But you need to know what's going on in your flock in order to make that decision.
So is that a conversation with your vet then as to whether vaccination is going to be appropriate for you in line with all the other things in the 5-point plan we've discussed?
Yeah, it's worth having a conversation with your vet. But remember, the more the vet knows, the more of an informed decision they can make. So you do need to have that information available for them and have some sheep that they can examine so they can be aware of the what is causing lameness in your flock. And it is dynamic as well. You'll get seasons where the foot rot is a problematic. So it's an ongoing task, really, to put together a lameness plan and get on top of it.
And these farm-specific vaccines you were testing then, do you think they will come into the picture more, or do you think footvax will be the thing that we stick with and keep using?
The issue we have is there isn't really an incentive for a manufacturer to spend a massive amount of money, introduce a new vaccine into a sector that probably proportionately doesn't spend that much money, which is why it's been so valuable to have HDB as a partner. So this basically impartial research can only be done because we have this money from HDB. Now, that's not to say the company in Australia might be interested when they examine the results, but I think it's quite a leap, and sometimes we have to think a little bit beyond as to how to fund this sort of thing. I think there's potential in the vaccine because it was a PhD project. It's very limited in the time it can run for. So we've shown in theory it can work, even though there's multiple serogroups in the flock. If it was possible to have followed this through for 2 years, maybe, and do what the Australians do, which is sequentially vaccinate for all of the strains as and when they become the more dominant ones, then we might have seen it sort of overtake footvax perhaps. But I think, say, a lot of the useful things that have come out of this is really just understanding how the footvax works better. Yeah. I also did have some CODD in the flocks, and so I was personally I'm pretty interested in this disease, and it's a shame we don't have more research on it. But what I didn't use at any point in this trial is the long-acting antibiotics, the more expensive ones. And by catching lame sheep once a week, I was able to stop those CODD lesions from really getting a hold, and they would heal rather than the hoof coming off. They would heal in response to my antibiotic treatment.
Brilliant. Brilliant, thank you. So, Liz, you did a webinar for us a little while ago. I think it was just before Christmas. So if anybody does want to watch that webinar and have a look at Liz's results with slides, they're available on the AHDB Beef and Lamb YouTube channel, and there is a link in the text attached to this podcast as well. So I just want to move briefly on to preparing for lambing then, Liz. So we're recording this, I don't know if it's the 1st or 2nd of February, but it's the beginning of February. So we have just got time to change a few things before lambing for those March, April lambers. So there are reported iodine shortages this year. Mm. What can we do now to ensure that lambing goes well and that doesn't have a big problem?
Yeah, sure. It really just means we need to emphasise how well we feed our sheep and keep the environment clean as possible for the lambs. So disease is a result of the amount of environmental challenge in balance with the amount of immunity that the animal that's being challenged has. So it's a fine balance. And we use the iodine dip to reduce the challenge, but we can also be scrupulous in the way we clean out bedding, lambing pens, anything that lamb's going to have access to and come into contact with. So clean, dry bedding, avoiding the use of wet disinfectant. If you can source some iodine, it's really important to make sure it is strong iodine, which is 10% and above, really, by definition.
And is that just printed on the bottle, is it, or do you need to ask for that?
It should be. You should be able to see that on the label. There have been issues for a few years now where they haven't been as strong as they've said, so, and farmers have noticed that because they can tell that it's not as sort of thick, really. Spraying is not an alternative, certainly not with antibiotic sprays. So the way the iodine dip works is it's an astringent, it actually dries out the navel, and that's how it has that protective effect, and you don't see that with the sprays, and certainly not the antibiotic sprays. They're designed to do an entirely different job. So you may come across some other proprietary products. There's very little sort of published, reliable literature out there to make any informed decisions on whether one is as good as iodine or another. Just bear in mind that the product is designed to, say, dry out the navel and function that way, and also really last and not be toxic, because obviously ewes tend to lick our dips back off again and we have to reapply them. So just bear that in mind when you're looking at an alternative, if you do have access to that. And then the other side of the balance is the immunity, and that comes from really good quality colostrum, and that depends not only on what you feed the ewes but also how you feed the ewes. We would have to have significantly longer for me to go through all that, but if in doubt, get someone who you trust upon your local sheep vet or feed advisor to look at that. Forage analysis, always a great idea. It wasn't done commonly in the area that I was working, but we conversed with a few people. And also, in any doubt about if your diet's working or not, if you're not yet at 3 weeks pre-lambing, then metabolic profiling, so actually blood testing your sheep to see whether the diet's working, is another option. So hopefully we've covered that quite concisely. But yes, cleanliness and colostrum, good quality colostrum.
So cleanliness, colostrum, dip not spray, yeah, and making sure you've got strong iodine.
If you can get, yeah.
If you,
yeah,
can get
and
it.
Make sure it is strong if you,
yeah,
if you think it's being sold as strong, yeah.
And just going back to colostrum quickly, how much should those, I'm saying this as we're in colostrum is gold month now, with it being February, how much should lambs be getting colostrum-wise?
Colostrum-wise. So it's 50 mils per kilo in the first sort of 4 to 6 hours. And it's about 280 mils in the first 24 hours. So if you were to have to milk that out and give it, that looks alarmingly large amount of colostrum. Now, one thing that's really caught on in the last few years is colostrum testing.
Yeah.
Because it's not just quantity, it's got to be quality as well. So Brix refractometers are really popular, inexpensive tool now that a lot of flocks are starting to have. So if you're topping up, we make sure that the colostrum is quality enough in the first place.
And what do you look for on the Brix refractometer?
There's a scale on the Brix refractometer. It has to be nearly at the top of the scale. I've not personally used one of these,
right,
because these have come, I'd say I've been out the loop for a few years, but
yeah.
You're looking for above 26.5.
Okay.
Which is apparently right at the top of the
scale.
Okay. Yeah, so that's the Brix. And then these Easy Milk devices are getting quite popular now, because say you're busy, you're tired in the lambing shed, physically, manually milking out a nice single ewe with plenty of colostrum is hard work when you rest off your feet. So I hear the Easy Milk devices are really, really popular solution to speeding that process up.
Brilliant. Thank you, Liz. So as a vet, is there anything else that farmers should be doing more of in the run-up to lambing? Or you go on farm when you were practicing and go, blimmin' heck, I wish they'd have done that, or I wish they weren't doing that. What would kind of your top things be as such?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll put this one out there. Housing, although it's an increased risk for lameness because they're all together, it's also quite a good time to get on top of things if they've been out of control. So one thing I wouldn't do is put the lame ewes in the pen with all the rest of the other ewes. They should be separate and,
right,
and having special treatment.
Yeah.
And also really trying to get them right before turnout, so you're turning out a sound flock.
Yeah.
So with my lameness hat on, I'm going to put that one out there.
And would you be you'd be turning those after they've lambed, have they, or just thinking?
Well, I guess it depends on the system, right, but I'd be mindful that you've got an opportunity to put a non-lame flock back out in the field with some lambs that potentially are going to go on to get schooled within a few weeks anyway. So bear that in mind. There is no excuse to not catch and treat heavily pregnant ewe for lameness. Chances are she's in pain, she's not going to be eating, so there's no harm in, there's more good than harm than catching a ewe and making sure she gets prompt treatment the same as the others. So that's an important message. I might just stick with that because I could go on for a long time if we go down this route. And there are many things to look at, but they do tend to be farm specific.
thank you, Liz, and thank you for your time today. So what you don't know if you're listening to this is Liz's fifth event in about a day and a half, and we've got another one this afternoon. So we're going to move on to a discussion group this afternoon with Shropshire. So if you'd like more or any information on anything we've discussed today, please visit the AHDWE website where you'll be able to find our information, tools and resources. There's lots on there, both about lameness and reducing lamb losses as well. Or you can contact your local knowledge exchange manager. So I'm Emma. Thank you for listening. And thank you, Liz, for joining us.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have any ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk. We want to hear from you.